You're listening to Your Music, Your Business, a podcast helping you to explore the business behind your music.
Hello all and welcome back to Your Music, Your Business, a podcast helping musicians and industry professionals understand the music business. Today I'm joined by Mark Brown, the founder of Biter, a platform enabling musicians, their teams, and their collaborators to send and receive digital audio in a clean, simple, and secure way. Mark is also our very first international guest, currently residing in Sweden. Welcome, Mark. Thank you so much for joining the podcast.
Thanks. First international guest. What an honor. I didn't know.
Yes.
Very exciting.
Look out. And our audience is predominantly Australian, so this will be a nice change of accent between the two of us, I think.
Oh yeah, no, it's brilliant. Wow. Okay, cool.
Yeah. Well, firstly I want to jump into sort of asking you a little bit more about yourself, because I know our audience will be very curious. Can you start by telling us a bit about what Biter does?
So yeah, it's actually Biter, which is the Swedish word for exchange. You're saying it the way everybody says it, so don't worry.
Yes.
About it. But it actually means exchange in Swedish, or to swap. And so, Biter is a platform for sending and receiving digital audio. Because if you think about it, you and your job, or anybody who works in and around music, anybody listening, everybody's sending and receiving music all the time. And when I was working as a radio plugger in London a handful of years ago, I just realized that like the way people were sending and receiving digital audio is terrible. It's a mess. And so it is, exactly. And it's the foundation. If you send me something as a man, is you as a manager send me something and I can't listen to it, or it's difficult, or I can't be bothered because there's too many clicks, then I'm not, you know, that's a failure for the artist. And it's the same when I was a radio plugger trying to convince people at radio stations to listen to music. If they can't listen to it, then there's no way they're going to realize how brilliant the artist is. And that's the first step. It's the currency. That's what everybody trades on.
That's exactly right.
Especially at the start for new and emerging artists. If you don't have good music, it doesn't matter because you don't have a story yet. So that was the foundational idea for Biter.
Amazing. And is that why you decided to found a company working specifically in digital audio? Because you have a passion for that and you found it was such a pain point for you? Or
yeah, like well, I think you, based on what we were talking about before you pressed record, like you end up doing things. You just come up with an idea and you're like, I see this as a problem, I'm going to solve it. And I like to say that I was sort of naive enough and dumb enough to think to myself, oh, well, I can solve that problem.
Yeah.
Because, you know, like working in the music business is one thing, you know, building a startup in music tech is another thing. But that was basically it. I thought, this is a serious problem. Everybody has it. People listening to music is the key, is foundational, like I said. Mm. And I thought, well, okay, it's a foundational problem. That's pretty big. So I can solve this problem.
Exactly right. And it's funny you say that. I think most of the people on the podcast don't know quite yet, but I've started delving into the startup world in the music industry, which you will all hear more of very soon. But it's funny how you reflected then of sort of feeling really naive of like, oh, I'm just going to fix this issue. It's going to be so easy. And I think the reality is that the startup world is not easy. It's you're fixing an issue and it's still an issue for a reason, because it's not straightforward.
But I see. So the thing is, like, I think I'm older than you are. So like I'm 47, 48. And I've got a lot of friends who have decided they wanted to maybe do something else. And they always say to themselves, oh, I don't know anything. I only worked in music for 25 years. And I'm always like, that is just complete crap, because it's very hard to work in music. It's like basically the music business is like Vietnam. You know, there's bodies littered all over the side of the road. So the startup world is difficult. Yeah, you're laughing, but the startup world is difficult, but so is the music business. And I think it's challenging to do something creative or to support people that are creative. I think that's just the way it is. So I've never thought to myself, I can't do anything else. It's more that I worked in music for 25 years. Mm-hmm. I guess I still work in music. And I thought, oh, okay, I can apply these skills elsewhere.
Yeah.
So it is intimidating, but you know, being an artist, starting being in a band or whatever, you have the same, what is it, naivete? Is that the, like, you don't know what you're doing. And if you knew what you were doing, you would never get involved. So
exactly right.
If you don't know what you're doing, that is sort of a good thing in a way.
Yeah. I think. Yeah, well, that's completely true. I think I've definitely found in, like, I've been doing the startup or exploring my startup for the last few months, and I just completely agree with you about how much does link from the music world into that startup world, because it's just you. It's almost the same personality types. It's the driven. It's ambitious. It's questioning life. It's questioning, like, exactly what you want to fix and how and who it helps and all that sort of thing. And realistically, that is music in a nutshell. It should just be about the music now, always, but at the end of the day, it's not. And you're always questioning how you're going to, you know, affect these people or those people. And it's so closely linked to startups. It's hilarious. I think everyone gets a little bit scared about startups and you're like, well, it's actually just the same as releasing music realistically.
it's against all odds. Being successful in music, it's hopeless.
Yeah.
But I've worked with tons of artists over 25 years who have been very successful. So why can't someone else do it? Do you know what I mean? Like, if you sat there and thought, I can't do it, I'm not good enough, you'd cower in the corner of your room. Like, you got to give it a go. And if you're not good enough at it now, you could be good enough at it later. Is the way I see it. It's so terribly naive, but that's the way I see it.
A little bit of naivety does help.
It's all you've got, really.
That's exactly right. Oh, that's fantastic. Now, I may end up pronouncing the business name incorrectly the whole time.
but refer to it as the business name. Just say it.
Okay. Well, Bider offers a unique selling point for musicians, different to that of your competitors, in which musicians can actually watermark their work through your platform. Can you explain the importance of watermarking music for us?
Yeah, so watermarking is a feature, and for people who don't know what that is, it's where we inject an inaudible sound I've got the Swedish word in my head, an oxymoron, sorry, that you can put an inaudible sound in something. But that's what we do. We embed it in the file, and then so if the file ends up in the wrong hands, we can track it back to the person who received it. And that is something that maybe a lot of artists wouldn't know about, but record labels have used for years, 10, 15, 15 years. But really, what that is it's a feature that lies under something that's important to us, and that's that word that you mentioned before, like secure. Mm. So if you're releasing music as an artist or a manager, the only thing you have left now is sort of the element of surprise. And this is why I always refer to, like, Beyonce or whatever, like, she just drops a record out of nowhere.
Yeah.
Because she wants to control the narrative, and artists, all they have left is the narrative. So the key when you're releasing music or you're sharing it with people is you want to get it to the people you want to get it to. You want them to listen to it, but you might not necessarily want everybody else to have it if it's unfinished or unmastered or anything like that, or different versions, and you're just looking for feedback. And so we make it, people can't rip the links, our links, so they can't download the streams unlike other platforms. And so we just focus on security. For that reason, we want to make sure that when people use our platform, that they feel that they can send it to people and then, for example, kill the link right away. So if I send something to you and I realize that I don't want you to have it, or you know, I can kill that link and basically it expires immediately to anybody I sent it to. And so it's those kind of features that watermarking sits under, that certain people have different risk tolerances for the music they share with people. And watermarking is a way to prevent things ending up with the wrong people, but it's more to disincentivize people, because a watermarked stream only behind a login. So if you force someone to have an account and it's a stream only and it's watermarked, is about as secure as you're going to get on the internet.
Yeah.
And so some people really think that's important. Other people, like newer artists, some of them just think, oh, the track's finished. If somebody spreads it around, it's good news for me.
Yeah.
But in that building a release plan and doing all those different things, you have different levels of risk and different levels of, and risk sounds, it sounds like all highbrow or something, but it's, you want to be, you're proud of the work you made, or you're nervous about it, or you're both of those things at the same time. And you want to just get it to people who you trust, and you want to make sure that they don't send it to other people. So that's where the watermark comes in. It's part of this idea that you want to be comfortable with security. And we know that that is a common element for everybody working with digital audio, and they just have different preferences, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And different emphasis on that security and when they want it and how. Because realistically, as you gave a great example before, new and emerging artists don't necessarily care because it's all good press, but the further up you get and the more people that are involved in the project, it's only going to be a negative thing if it gets out before it's ready. Well, not only, but predominantly a negative thing.
Yeah, it is. And funny enough, so we do these monthly events and I do a little talk at the start, like we had someone from CD Baby on, and we've had people from YouTube and Believe and all this kind of stuff. And I do a little talk at the start and I go through some of these. We have this strand called How We Listen, which is based on the education side of our business. And we started this other, it comes from this interview series we started called How We Listen. And then we also started this other one called Method to My Music, which is where we interview artists about the creative process. And in my talk at the start of this monthly event, I was reading a couple highlights from one of these Method to My Music. And a hip hop producer recently, he was talking about how he sent his beat to someone, and then they sent it to someone else, and then they sent it to someone else, and then it ended up in a track. And it's not, people don't really, I don't think people actively pirate things anymore. It's very 5 years ago. But
yes,
the idea that sort of something ended up somewhere by mistake is very 2022, really. Mm-hmm. You know, like, oh, I sent it to him, and then they sent it to them, and they sent it to them. So it's not this, oh, it's going to get leaked before release, because we're not all Beyonce.
No.
But at the same time, things end up where they shouldn't, because people don't think. And I think even newer emerging artists are worried about that. And we want to make it comfortable that what they're sharing is as secure as they want it to be. Because if you don't send your music out, no one's going to know who you are. Back to what we were saying at the start. If you don't send it out to anyone, that's as secure as you get.
Yes.
Like that Wu-Tang album, there was one copy of it. If you never want anyone to hear your album, don't send it out, or your track.
Right.
But that's unrealistic. So, you know, you've got to send it out. And that's when I do talks and stuff. That's what I talk about a lot, is this idea that, you know, you've got to figure out what's right for you.
Yeah. I want to touch on the fact that it is a global company, and that in the bio it does say that it runs across three continents. What have you found to be some of the biggest differences between some of those key territories in regards to music and releases, and how safe and secure they want them?
Okay, so let's touch on the distributed team thing. So a distributed team is, pre-pandemic, no one would have ever, you know, people didn't talk about it as much. But we started our company in London, there were three of us and we all work from home, right? Mm. And then there's an Australian connection here. My co-founder, Jen, lives outside Melbourne. She lives on the coast. So she moved to, so she moved to Melbourne. And I'm like, well, this is it. The company shot to bits here. And this is, you know, 5-6 years ago.
Yeah.
And actually, there was no change. So, you know, like we just did meetings on, I think Slack and maybe just started or something. Or anyway, so it was pretty easy to communicate. And then I'm like, well, if Jen's moved to Australia, I'm moving to Sweden. So because this was around the time of Brexit and all this kind of stuff. I'm like, it's unfair that she gets to live in Australia. So I'm moving to Sweden. So and so that's how it started. The three of us lived in different places and we all had jobs and it was like this was a side project. And then we sort of just became this company that didn't have an office. And that's just sort of the way it was. So now we have, and then we got a couple of years ago, we got some funding. So we have people in Canada, in the UK, Sweden, and Australia. And it sounds like crazy, but if anybody knows, like WordPress, the company that owns WordPress, I think they're called Automatic or something, they're fully distributed. And I think they have hundreds of employees. We only have like 10 or 12 or whatever. So we don't like, so it just, it's natural for us. And now that the pandemic's happened, people are like, oh, well, I don't need to go to the office. Like people who used to love to go to the office are like, screw that. I could stay at home and do my laundry all day while I talk on Zoom, you know?
So, exactly.
Yeah. So, but as far as like, you know, thinking about different music businesses, like industries. One of the things I thought like at the start of the call was you were saying you're in Australia, like Canada's a lot like Australia, I think. Small markets, you know, domestically you can do okay, but you know, you got to blow up somewhere else really for it to be. But Canada's exported a lot of good music and so is Australia.
Yeah.
So like there's those parallels. I think Europe is different because everything's so close together. The UK music business is the one I know the best. It's also the most exciting. I think when things start to happen in the UK, it's pretty exciting because it's only one time zone. I've written about this before. So it's only one time zone, which means everybody listens to the same radio stations when they used to listen to the radio. And everything happens, but it's true though, everything happens in the same time zone. Whereas in the US, you know, like people are in what, four or five different time zones. In Canada, there's, I think, five. So it's very fragmented in that way. Those are the big things that I notice, you know.
That's fantastic. And in regards to the same time zones, how much of a player in releasing music, do you think that actually has? Like, does it make a big difference, the fact that everyone is on the same time zone? Is it because you're hitting more of an audience, like a wider audience right at the same time, in a time that's convenient for them?
So, like, well, think about, like, sort of 10 years ago, like, not pre-internet, but before the internet, before streaming. So because, like, something like streaming now, Spotify and stuff, like it means that people have access to everything and it means that music is more diverse. This is the way I see it. People might disagree. Music is more diverse. People listen. Their attention spans are a bit more scattered, but they have access to lots more diverse music. You know, people get stuck in their little channel, what they listen to. But I find I listen to a lot more different types of music than I used to before. But if you look at 10 years ago in the, say, the UK, and you wanted to hear a new track, that track might get debuted on a breakfast radio show that everybody is listening to at once. So there was a lot more focus. Think about like live TV and stuff. Like I don't listen to live TV, like, watch live TV. I don't watch or listen to live TV. But before, there was these points, there were these cultural inflection points where everybody was involved in like hearing something for the first time. And that doesn't that's less important now, but it was, or so I don't know how important it is now, but it was super, super, it was a big deal. Like, that's why UK radio was a big deal when I worked in it, even 10, 15 years ago. Huge. To get everybody's ears on the same track at once is a very exciting thing, really. Because you'd see the reaction it shows. You'd be like, exactly. Oh, that's on the radio, and people be going crazy. You could tell.
Yeah. And it's also hitting such a wide audience at the one time. And it's like, I don't think many people have come at that perspective to me. It's like the fact that we're all in the same time zone. Australia is not, we're close, but we're not the same time zone exactly. And I think just giving the emphasis of that is so important, and something that, you're right, it's hard to gauge now in the structure that the music industry is at right now, and how digital it is, and how much we don't rely on being in front of a radio or being in front of a TV at a certain point. But it does make a difference realistically, 100%.
And like, I think, like, so I'm very lucky because I got to live in a world without the internet, because it was different. It wasn't better or worse. It was just different. But like, for people who, you know, come from smaller communities or felt, or even lived in a bigger community and felt isolated, like had different musical interests or felt different for one reason or another. And there are multiple reasons that people feel that way. Like, the fact that the internet exists and the way people connect with music now is, things are a lot more accessible. Whereas before, like, who wants to listen to The Breakfast Show on Radio 1 in the UK if you don't like pop music? That wasn't for you. It was very isolating in a lot of ways. So that's what's interesting now, that you can totally find your crowd anywhere. Yeah. And I think that's a good thing. So you connect with the people you want to connect with at the time that you want to do it, at your convenience. And that, I think that's very powerful. And maybe that there's some negatives to that. I can't really think of them at the moment, but I'm sure there is. But that balance and that, the way things have changed, I think is quite exciting.
Yeah. Well, I think if we're going to point out a potential negative to that, is what you've already touched on, is the oversaturation of that. It's like, the more you can see and have access to whenever you want, the more there's just so much out there, and that every single genre is at your fingertips now whenever you want it. And it does make it harder for the average musician to break through.
Yeah. And I think, like, that's another thing I talk a lot about when I do talks, is this idea in the 90s, like the 4-track and the 8-track were only becoming popular, like home recording. And so it went from this period where it was very, very, very difficult to release a record. And this is important for anybody listening to think about. Back then, it was hard to put a record out. So there were what you call gatekeepers. I hate that word. But the idea that people could prevent you from being, you had to jump through all these hoops, right? Yeah. And nowadays, you don't have that. Anybody can release music, but that means that anybody can release music. And so it's easy to release music. It's hard to get noticed. Whereas before, because it was harder to get music released, there was less competition to get noticed, if that makes sense.
Complete.
So that transition is fascinating. Fascinating.
Yeah, exactly. And that's pretty much the music industry in a nutshell, like that transition. And that sort of does lead me into my question of touching on the fact that you were around in that space and were working really closely with radio and some of those really key influences and record labels and things. And to now, where you still are within that realm and working with musicians, I think personally, I find that everyone says that decentralization of needing a record label and needing that funding and that gatekeeping being there is the biggest positive. What do you feel is a close second to that? Like, what is a positive that's come out of it, apart from the whole more musicians getting seen more?
I come from like a DIY background, like a do-it-yourself background. So all this stuff is not new, you know, artists taking control. Like on my first job in Canada, I worked at an artist-run label. So it was a band that became quite big. And then they started releasing records by their friends. So none of this is new. But I think what's good about it is that you can run your show any way you want. And this is also a negative, because there's a level of option paralysis that people are like, I have so many great options here. I don't know what the hell to do. But I think what it does show, here's an answer that I'm just making up on the spot, is that it shows how important knowledge is. Mm-hmm. Because sure, you can put out a record tomorrow, but it doesn't mean it's going to go well. The value is not in the fact that you have a record label or a manager or any of these people. It's the knowledge they have. And you have to pick right. You know, it's not, like the difference back when everybody had to have a record label. What was that? If you pick a shitty record label, it's even worse than doing it yourself. But it's true, though. And that is the same today, that you still need people to guide you, because they're the ones that have the experience. They're the ones that don't have access necessarily, but they know the people.
Yeah.
Who, because they're professionals, like as a radio plugger, what you're doing is, it's not that I was some genius. It was just that I talk to those people all the time because I did that little small job. Right.
Yeah.
And I think the way it is now, it really does show that knowledge is power, that the mechanics are easy to repeat. Mm. You can put out a new record every day and have them all fail. Or you can put them out every day and have them all work. And it's the knowledge behind how you do it. And I like that. Like, I think that's a good thing, that the knowledge is out there. And that's how you become successful. You just fail, and then hopefully learn to get better at something. And then suddenly over time, it starts to work. I think that would be my answer.
Yeah, that's a fantastic answer. And I think it sort of touches on a little bit of something that we talked about before we hit record as well, is that you learn, like, everyone in the music industry has not come from one particular space and they've gone like up the same ladder, up the same staircase. There's all these different collections of experiences and knowledge base that comes from every single person that you meet, which makes my life and my podcast very, very interesting. But everyone has a very different background in their knowledge, and it's completely up to the musician to pick who they want to work with and what which knowledge base they feel comfortable with and what they want to take from it and don't want to take from it, because there's a lot to be said sometimes about listening to everything that somebody says but then also going to another source and hearing what they've got to say about the music industry, because everyone's going to have a very different opinion about how to release music and when and why and the best strategy to do it, because there's just so many ways.
And I think like that can be intimidating for artists, that there's a lot of advice. So, but you know, those monthly How We Listen Live, it's called, these talks that I introduce myself, I say who I am, and then I explain my background. I do it every month, because I think it's super important that people understand that different perspectives come from, just like in life, if you grow up in a certain different place, and it's like, you know, all those kind of things play into your worldview. It's the same in music, that I started in an independent label and then I moved to the UK. So I've worked in a couple different music markets, and then I live in Sweden, and I did promotion, radio plugging. And those are the things, it's very important that you understand the different perspectives that are happening and how, like I call it decentralized tension, that as an artist, you have all these people working on your release, right? Yeah. And they don't all get along. Like, not every PR person likes the manager, but that tension, when it works, creates the environment combined with very good music creates that spark that's needed to have something explode. And you can't you can't design that. You can do, well, you can design the team and combined with the good music, but you can't, it's not a repeatable process.
Yeah.
And it's like so super important for artists, talking about record labels again, like that they know and understand that the people that they're working with, it's the theory behind how they approach things that's most important. So thinking, is this person, do they see the world, do they have the same worldview as me? I think is, have I gone off to, I feel like I've gone off tangent on a tangent with this answer, but maybe I've pulled it back to the.
So no, I think you answered my question and then we delved a little bit further into it.
Okay, good. Phew, thank you.
We're still on task. It's good. And if anything, you're great. Actually helping me like set up my next question.
Oh, good. Okay.
It's the fact that like you have worked with multiple record labels and you have done, you know, the UK radio promotion, and now you're running a company with digital audio in mind, as well as like everything else that's been fit into your career. So what I'd love for the listeners to hear is like, from everything that you've experienced so far, what has been your biggest takeaway or your biggest lesson from your career that you wish younger you would have known?
The younger me, that's a weird one, because I don't know. I would say that, like, if I knew then what I know now, you wonder if you'd ever get into it, because it's not easy working in music, exactly. And it's not easy running a startup. But I think I would probably give myself the confirmation that it's worth trying. That sounds terribly sort of lame, but
no, it's totally worth
going for it. Because who wants to work in a fucking bank? Like I like fintech, like financial tech, like that kind of stuff's sort of interesting. But who wants to work at a bank when you go in there and everybody's stamping and it's just computer says no and there's no creativity? It's totally worth it for all the pain. It's totally worth it just trying to do something, because you'll never regret it. You learn so much aside from about yourself. I think there's a personal discovery that goes on with, and artists and musicians especially, like going on tour and seeing the world and creating, getting paid hopefully to create what you think is important. Like art, you know, and I consider music a form of an art form.
Yeah.
Is the most rewarding thing ever, really.
Yeah, that's incredibly true. And I think that's something that I've sort of, when I thought about what I would tell my younger self, is like, just give it a try. Like, and also reaffirming that I can do it. No, that's a big thing for me. I think younger me would have been like, yeah, you can't do that.
Well, you most certainly couldn't do it back then, but you've taught yourself how to do it. And that's, it's very like, if I had to put it into a sound bite, I would tell the younger me that no one knows what the fuck they're doing.
Yes.
That's the most important thing. You look at people and you think they totally know what they're doing. Total crap. Everybody's just winging it. That would be the piece of info I'd give anyone. It's like, you look at people all the time, they got no idea what they're doing.
Yep. And that those
and that makes it exciting. That makes
it exciting. Exactly. And that even those people that are sitting in really high up positions in really important businesses, like the CEO of Sony or whatever it's going to be, they still don't feel like they're good enough most of the time.
Yeah.
They're still doubting themselves. They're still learning.
And they're there to be hustled.
Exactly.
You know, if you're an artist that they want that uncertainty is, and this is, I hope is not super, this sounds like, I don't know if you know who Robert Greene is. Have you ever heard of Robert Greene? He's a writer and he wrote like is it the 48 laws of power or whatever? And he wrote a book with 50 Cent and The Art of Seduction. So he's like, he talks about like power relationships and stuff. And so this sounds like something he would say, but like those people, that's what you need to know, that someone at a record company, they need to confirm their position at all times. So they're always on the lookout for new and interesting music, and they don't want to be left behind. And I think like a lot of people love music, so it's not cynical, but that's what you need to think as an artist. If you know your music is good, those people will be interested. That's the most fascinating part, because they're desperate to find new music and to confirm for themselves that they have good taste and that they can find artists and break artists. And so knowing that those people have the same weaknesses that we all do is a good thing in a way. Yes. And you can work together. You can use that weakness to everybody's advantage as an artist.
Yes. And that you can talk to them like a human as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Huge. Like, and if you can't, fuck them, because then they're not the right people.
Yeah.
You know, like people need to be humble and open and accessible. Otherwise, it's not going to work anyway. And that's a problem that I think newer artists have, that we all have. You think you're desperate to get going, but maybe certain, you've got to work with the right people. Otherwise, it will never work, I think.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I had this conversation with somebody who's in a band today, when you're just looking at that very insulated experience of being in a band and realizing that somebody else has now got a mortgage and maybe their priorities aren't the same as everyone else in the band. And it's like, well, you've got to work with the people that work well, because you're either going to try and push this band for another 5 years, invest thousands more money into it, and then realize that you all now have mortgages and you all now need to step away from the project and waste all that money, or you cut it now and you go find a project where everyone's life is and everyone wants to be in it, sort of thing. And it can be so important, even from a micro and then a huge scaled up version.
It's very it's those kind of things that remind you that it's very fragile. Creation, like creating things, it's a very, very, very fragile process. Because what you're saying makes complete sense. And it's not about the mortgage either. The mortgage just represents something like, not a physical thing, but like a reality.
Yeah.
Whereas it's really about people's attitudes towards things. It's attitude towards themselves and attitude toward each other.
Yeah.
And I think it is, so how any band becomes successful is mind blowing, especially bands that become very big. And, it's like returning back to Earth, where the rocket blows up, because it's the amount of external stress and pressure is monumental. I don't think people understand or fully appreciate what that does to the people in a band and the people working around them. So what you're saying makes complete sense.
It's exactly right. It's like the further up you get, the bigger you become, it's like it becomes this all-encompassing, surrounding every part of your life sort of situation. And it can be a really positive experience, but then also a really negative experience. And definitely, if you know going into it that you've got that team there that's right for you and your project and also where you're at personally in your own life at that given time, then fantastic. And if not, then there may be some counseling or some psychology in your future.
so, but here, Australian reference, what's his name? Daniel Johns from Silverchair.
Mm.
I saw an interview with him recently, and he's, I'm no Silverchair fan or whatever, but like he's clearly had a very rough ride, and I don't even think he's friends with the people in the band anymore. And it's like, and when I see that, I think like, that sucks that people become like, at least he's still alive. Loads of people end up taking extreme measures. And I think, you mentioned that you had someone from a mental health organization or support network in music. And it's like people, I think, forget about how, or they think, oh, that's not going to happen to me. But it's very, very dramatic how much mental pressure, because it's a very social industry and a social business and a social environment. And it can be very, very stressful. It can be very stressful. So, yeah, like there's a lot. Again, though, if you think about that going into it, you'd be too intimidated.
Exactly.
And I think you just have to do it and hope that everything is going to be all right.
Yes, that's exactly right. And also, I think what is really interesting, particularly in Australia, is that there's actually a few organizations that are actively aiming to educate small businesses, at least, on how to provide mental health first aid. So I actually have first aid in how to support someone's mental health. And it's actually a topic that is interwoven into my business model as management. And I do mental health check-ins and all that sort of thing with my artists because it is so important and because it is so consuming of the music, but then also the career of everyone. Because I think what a lot of people don't see also is that the music industry is made up of a lot of people that have no corporate background about how teamwork connects and how best to communicate to people and how to not hurt people's feelings and how to manage certain stress and hit deadlines.
Yeah, I'm laughing. I'm laughing, but not because I should be, but because like it's what you're describing is the opposite. The music business or the music ecosystem, as I like to call it, is the opposite of that.
Exactly.
And I know the corporate world is super stale and boring, and who wants to work in a bank? But you know, when the music world is dysfunctional, it's terribly dysfunctional. And I wanted to say someone on our team, Jamie, who lives in the UK, he did the same course.
Really?
Like a mental health. Yeah, like first aid course. He did it during the pandemic or whatever. So like that kind of stuff is super, super important. Like it's very, but yeah, like I laugh because it sort of makes me nervous in a way. Like when you think of how unprofessional
I know.
The music world has been. And those, a lot of things, those things are getting a lot better.
Yes.
And I, of course it never moves fast enough. Like people are being, you know, the old guard are being, you know, phased out.
Yes.
And so things are getting better, but it is, it's, and I know like, that's the other thing I wanted to say. Like when I do talks and stuff again, like you hear from artists just how stressed they are about the pressure, all the crap they need to do, the social media, everything that you deal with a manager, like an artist had to deal with before you showed up to help them. And I think it's so intimidating to think, oh, how the hell am I going to do this all myself? And so it makes complete sense that mental health is an issue because it's like, you lose your mind. You literally lose your mind trying to be successful in music. So I sympathize. I think it's terrible. Yeah.
Exactly. And it's like, it's not even just the fact that you lose your mind just trying to figure out the music industry and how best to release. But then as a musician, you also in a lot of ways have to sell a version of yourself. And that's incredibly exhausting and draining. It's like you have to sell and give your image across to people. And like that is, I think we hear that, I've heard that a lot come back from musicians of like being so good or a particular brand, or like when you think of like the musicians that came from that Nickelodeon world or whatever you're going to call it, or the Disney world, that they were told that they have to act in a particular way, and then you put a musician like music careers around that. It's just like, it's mind-boggling.
But the funny thing is though that like everybody wears a mask. If you take, say you and I, we go work in a bank, we'd have to wear a different mask to survive in that environment. And so it's a lot more natural. It's a part of being human that you have to fit in. And I think, but that is what artists are doing. They're trying to fit in because they think they need to be a certain way to be successful. And that's the problem. It's not because everybody, you need to be, as a musician or an artist, you need to be professional and you need to be reliable and you need to learn, you need to hustle. But to contort yourself into being something you're not is a lot different. And I think that's the issue, is that a lot of people think I need to do all these things because that's what other people want. And again, like if you want to talk about advice to give your younger self, it's like, don't even waste your time trying to be something you're not. Figure out who you are and just be that person. And that's the same as an artist. Like, you know, figure out what you want as an artist and then just do that. Because otherwise, you're going to end up being like, and I think if I use the Silverchair example, there was an Australian, it was like a 60 Minutes or something interview with him. And it's like, you sort of think he just got dragged towards something he wasn't, or a part of him got lost on the journey. And it's like, that's why I get the impression he's so damaged. It's just, he just got lost. And who wants that for anybody? But it happens because you're thinking about other people and not yourself, not who you are as an artist. And let's face it, like, why are you doing it if not for yourself? You're creating music for yourself, and you should be confident that what you're creating will connect with people, not thinking, what is it that other people want from me? I think.
Yeah, 100%. And I think to link in from the what you tell your younger self, I want to flip it on its head for our last question and talk about your older self and frame it in the way that I always ask everyone on every episode. And that is, when you're 90 years old and then in retirement home, and wanting to brag to your room neighbor about what you did during your very long life, what would you like to be able to say to them that you achieved?
No regrets. That's an achievement. I think if you could get to the end of the road, however long the road is, and not have any regrets, it's been a success. Because you gotta try things, and you shouldn't be afraid that those things don't work, or that things don't end up the way you expect them to. But as long as you don't like sit there and think, I should have done it, because I think like, and regret comes from not trying things, I think.
Yeah.
You know, like that you go sit in, I don't know why I'm harping on the banks here, but like you just working in a bank or a job that's not right for you and thinking, I want something else. You should try to find that something else, because maybe that something else isn't what you wanted. Like a good example is loads of musicians or people who work in and around music are failed musicians. And you sort of laugh at that.
Yeah.
But they started down a path and they tried something and they realized maybe making music or being a touring artist wasn't right for them. But then they found another way to have impact and they're happier in a lot of ways. And I think that is if they hadn't taken the chances, they wouldn't have ended up where they are. And that's a perfect way to look at it. And I think looking back and having regret about that you didn't try something would be like with your startup or whatever, you got to do it. I'm not going to tell you, like, I should be telling you, don't do that. It's crazy, but you'll regret it later if you don't try. And that's why it's important to do it. And I think that's the biggest thing that I would like to look back and think, you know, it wasn't ideal, but I don't regret any of the stuff I did. And I didn't make any terrible mistakes. You know what I mean? And that's where regret comes in. You think I made a big mistake.
That's fantastic. That's a great answer. I don't think we've ever had anybody that said they didn't want to have any regrets. That's amazing.
Okay. Thanks. Yeah.
I think a few of them come from a career background or like the sort of family that they want, or that they've, you know, they have an impact in the world or whatever. But regrets is a great one. And I think a hard one for most people.
But I think it's also like, you know, you want to give a universal answer. because like everybody will have different accomplishments. Like everybody will say something different if you wanted to make it super personal to each individual. But I think what's important is it's good to see the universal, like to see us all as we're all in the same boat here in a lot of ways. Like we're all different, but we're all sort of the same. And I think like that's what's fun about what we've been talking about is there's a lot of we're all everybody's sort of giving it a go here.
Exactly.
With varying results.
And I love that that's sort of been the theme of this podcast is sort of talking, or this episode has been talking about how we're all the same, but we all have such different backgrounds and different experiences, and you can find your own version of success in whichever way you want to in the music industry.
And that's the single most important. Sorry, I cut you off, but that's the single most important thing, I think, is that if you're going to do something, do it for yourself and do it the way you want to do it. You don't need to be crazy. And well, you can if you want, like if, you know, like, you know, live in a yurt and play, well, I don't know. I'm just making the triangle with no one around in the forest, or, you know, like do whatever you want, but it's like if you're going to have confidence about anything, have confidence that you're okay doing what you're doing. Cause otherwise it'll never work the way you want it to. So.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Well, thank you so much, Mark, for coming on the podcast and sharing your insight. It's been incredible.
Thanks so much. It was super fun. It was great to chat to you, and good luck with your startup. Keep me updated. Yeah.
Thank you. Definitely will. I'm on a roll.